Welcome to Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific or get down and dirty and do some basic teaching. This one will be question 34 from the 2016 HSC or final year school exam for physics. And this is five sub-questions there. I'll only do two sub-questions, and it's from Quanta de Quark. It deals with sort of an atomic physics standard model, a bit of quark, almost gets to discussing what quantum mechanics is, but without actually touching it. Now, this is the fourth generation of podcasts. The first was just, I would guess, read through the question and answer. Second generation is where I'd read through the formula sheet. Third generation is where I'd teach and go through the formula sheet and then do the question. And this is fourth generation. I didn't believe there'd be a fourth generation, where I read the question first, then do a teaching, then go through the formula sheet, and then actually answer the question. So let's start off. There are two questions, so I've sort of break this up into three podcasts of two questions, and the final question I'll just simply get in, do a bit of teaching, and then actually answer the question, because the last question is a 6-mark question, 6 out of 25. This is 25 marks, or 1/4 of the year, or 1/4 associated with it. Let's start at question A, part one. Identify two types of nucleon and state one difference between them. And that's for 2 marks. Explain the stability of helium-4. There's a 4 up there. A nuclei in terms of two forces. And question B is outline the features of the hydrogen spectrum that the Bohr model could not explain. Calculate, the second question is calculate the initial energy level of an electron in the hydrogen atom if it emitted so many joules on transition to the final n equals 2 level. Okay, or calculate the principal quantum number of the energy level, I suppose it would say. So let's do, as I've promised, a general teaching of nucleons and helium, the Bohr model, and spectra, how you calculate that. So we're going to teach in that general area. Now, unlike standard stuff, I'm a quantum physicist, and I'll teach at a slightly higher level than you go across. So the two nucleons, nucleons members of a nucleus, are called hadrons, or baryons, and they have a baryonic number of 1, and they consist of 3 quarks each. Remember, the two types of quarks which are stable and don't emit radiation, they last forever, the up and the down quark. The up quark is a charge of +2/3, the down quark is a charge of -1/3. So the combination of the two together form a combination of 3. There's 3 different colours. And the 3 different colours have to come together to form white. So they can form white by forming, say, a blue quark and an anti-blue quark. That's a meson, muon. I always refer to two out. Or you can get combinations of the 3 quarks together, and whatever they are, up or down, they have to have a different colour, and the sort of colour exchange force in gluons actually explains the strong nuclear force, and because a gluon has mass, the range of the force is very low. I'm just giving it out there. Sorry, friends, that's the way it is. Gluons actually stick it in those transitions, and you write this in Feynman diagrams. Which are sort of linear diagrams, but they actually don't represent, the lines actually don't represent physical motion of particles. We'll have to go into that at some point in time. So Feynman diagrams represent the space time or the timeline of things, so that they progress forward in time and exchange particles in Feynman diagrams. So our proton consists of two up and one down. That's two thirds plus two thirds go to four thirds minus a third goes to a plus charge of one, and it will have a spin of a half. So it can have a spin values, two quantum numbers, spin value. It can have spin plus a half or minus a half. That's probably an important point to remember for the down the track. Similarly for a neutron. A neutron also has a magnetic moment, I think much smaller though. It also has an equal spin. Neutrons, because they have no net charge, do not experience the electromagnetic force. So you can stick as many neutrons as you want together, but there's nothing particularly to bond them together because there's not sufficient gluons, because there's the unbalanced number of up and downs, quarks together. Now, they form together in a nuclear potential, which is short range, corresponding to the strong nuclear force. So there's two forces there. Two protons repel from each other. They would normally have sufficient repulsion if you didn't introduce the strong nuclear force with them by adding at least one neutron and even more neutrons to make it even more stable. There is this misunderstanding that the quark is extremely small, spatially small, but it's got a smaller mass, therefore it's actually got a larger wave function. Its actual size is rather large, but it actually interferes with each other. And there's a miscomprehension that the actual nucleon proton or neutron are largely empty space, but it is true that the actual mass of a quark is actually quite low. There's actually the binding energy mass and similar. So this is them moving around each other, adds up substantially to the mass of the proton and the neutron. That's the actual energy in there. These are not, quarks are not stable by themselves, so they've never been isolated by themselves. So there's I think Gower potential, an earlier potential where they have a repulsive inner core and a very short range attractive potential and then no potential after that. And then you would superimpose that for two protons. You would superimpose that with a coulombic repulsion potential, which would get sufficiently larger in height the more nucleons you had inside. So you have the coulombic repulsion potential would be 92 times higher in uranium, which has got a Z number of 92. Z number refers to the total number of protons, where the A number, which is the atomic mass number, refers to the total number of protons and neutrons. The actual mass of a nucleus, going back, this is not in any course, in fact even university courses, is the Saxon-Woods semi-empirical nuclear potential, which treats neutrons and protons as they should, as quantum mechanical particles. And in fact, in helium, the neutron, proton, each neutron and each proton has a mean position of exactly coordinate XYZ of 0, 0, 0. They do superimpose each other on space. It's not like the Bohr 1936 liquid drop model where you've got individual things. Look, I'm really just rambling on here. I hope people are getting up to it. So the actual nucleus, if you actually looked at it, would not, if you zoom up in a microscope, if you could, it wouldn't have those little balls. It would actually be just a fuzzy dot. And of course, a helium nucleus is actually relatively small because all the nucleons are sitting on top of each other. Those are two forces here. Moving on to Bohr. You have to understand who Bohr was and his situation. He'd seen Einstein produce something, and he had produced postulates and synthesized together I counted probably 15, possibly even 30 papers Einstein read at the same time. And produced in 1905, produced three simultaneous discoveries. One of the accounting for Brownian motion, the photoelectric effect, and special relativity, all in this miraculous year of 1905, 1911. We had Rutherford discover the nucleus, 1915. 16, Bohr came up with his molecule, his description, which is based not on quantum mechanics, hadn't been discovered, and the assumption is that the electron is a tiny little dot, and there was a Drude model saying that the metal was largely empty, except there was a spaced array of tiny nucleuses, and the electrons were free space and went along, and so the Drude model influenced, and that's 1901. Model, the Drude model, if you look it up, and that's still taught in schools today as the principal model for metals, even though it probably lasted less than 12 months in 1901. Similarly, the Bohr model, strictly speaking, should have been abandoned in 1926 with the, or was abandoned in 1926 with the quantum mechanics, but it was still such a good teaching model. It's a blackboard model. People still teach it today. So the Bohr model had, in light of Einstein's postulates is that all frames of reference have the same speed of light, and all frames of reference laws of physics are the same. They're what we call postulates. Bohr's sort of assumptions to make his equations work were that electrons orbit in stable circular orbits and don't radiate. They transition between the orbits emitting radiation. They jump between the orbits, in inverted commas, jump, because that is, they disappear from our universe and miraculously appear over here. So when I say jump, I mean that, say if you have a pencil on your desk, at the right-hand side, it will disappear and appear on the floor without clicking or anything like that. And finally, that there's a unit of angular momentum between these states. The states are defined by an angular momentum. I think it's either h on 2 or something along those lines. I'll have to go back up. And that h is actually a unit of angular momentum in kilograms, meters squared, seconds into the minus 1. There was a empirical model going before Bohr. So Bohr didn't develop this model. There was a model before accounting for the position of hydrogen lines, and the hydrogen lines show that the states were quantized. The energy is not quantized. The angular momentum is quantized between electrons between these states. And so he had the imaging of the lines on a spectrograph, and it's quite convenient with this blackboard model of a nucleus and electrons in orbits on the outside. You can actually see more or less that the spacing between lines looks like the spacing between orbitals, which is true to some extent. And so you can plug numbers into this orbital. I think I've come across something. Okay, now we come up to the formula sheet, and there's four formulas here. There's a formula from the main part of the course, which is E equals HF. H is Planck's constant, some very small number. I don't have it in hand, the actual small number they have there. F is the frequency in hertz. H is a unit of angular momentum, but it's also in another branch of physics, or not branch of physics, very similar branch of classical physics. It's something called an action, and an action is an integral. I'll keep going on the integral of a Lagrangian over periods between two periods of time. So H has got a unit of joule seconds. So if you multiply it by something which is in inverse seconds, which is a frequency, HF will give you an E. C is defined as equals F lambda for all frames of reference. So the frequency again times the wavelength in meters, the frequency in there. Then we have the next formula, which is 1 on lambda. Now, equals, why do we say 1 on lambda? Because that's what a lambda is, the wavelength in meters. There, and 1 on lambda actually refers to, I think if you multiply it by C, yeah, we'll get a frequency, and if you multiply it by H, you get an E. And so Rydberg, so that goes into 1 lambda equals big R into 1 on n final squared minus 1 on n initial squared. It's one of those things I came across. And I used to go through with the kiddies, but I always used to lose them how Bohr calculated that. And it's actually fairly simple, straight steps. Now, 1 lambda is a historical thing because that's what you'd measure in your spectroscopy. Rydberg constant, if you put in the first ionization level of hydrogen from the first level to ionization, so make n final infinite, n initial, 1 on n squared, and n is 1, so it's 13.6 eV, which is something you remember as a spectroscopist. Two sort of things. You remember that number, probably the ionization of helium, and you measure, remember that the wavelength in nanometers, 1,240 nanometers is 1 eV. So that wavelength is 1 eV, so half of that is 620 nanometers is 2 eV, 310 is 4 eV, 155 nanometers is 8 eV. It's just one of those things which automatically calibrates wavelength in nanometers into eV. Electron volts is the energy given out by a single electron falling over one volt. And there's finally a curve, a thing which makes sense dimensionally, because if H is angular momentum, which is momentum times a distance, okay, that's what H is. So if you put, and this is so confusing. Oh, look, they have got here a V in cursive. Lambda equals H on MV. So M is the mass of a particle, and V is its velocity. And you'd have to know that, because that would looks like a mu to me, frequency. Okay, so that's the formula sheet. Then that's time going through here. It's 19 minutes. My godfather. Okay, identify two types of nucleon and state one of the differences between them. Okay. So there are two types of nucleon, which are hadrons, protons, and neutrons. The difference between them is their quark composition. In terms of, that's one difference. I hope they'd pay that. Therefore, also their charge composition. Another difference is that a free proton is stable. Hydrogen is very stable. We know that's pretty much stable in the time of the universe. a neutron, I can't remember, it's a quarter of an hour, it's 999 seconds, something like that, seconds. It's unstable. Another difference is that a neutron is a little bit heavier than a proton. Another difference is the magnetic moment in their spin. Okay. Neutrons will also spin in a line to the magnetic field, but they won't be able to be excited by EM pulses. Just an interesting thing. So I should get to there, just to read what their answers are. Sample answer identifies two nucleons and states a difference. For 2 marks, two types of nucleons are neutrons and protons. Protons are positively charged, whereas neutrons have no charge. That's the only difference that you're expected to mark. Now, be warned that the way I'm answering it is not exam level. I'm giving you more information to help you out. Question A2, explain the stability of the helium 4 nuclei in terms of the two forces. Now, it just so happens that helium 4 is about the most stable. I think it is the most stable. Obviously, it's more stable than a proton, but just by itself, because you release energy. So I think that's it's a remarkably stable stuff. So the two forces is the strong nuclear force for 3 marks. So the strong nuclear force, you probably would get another mark by supervising that strong nuclear force interacts between protons and neutrons, or proton-neutron, it's by gluons and it's short range. I don't know whether you get a mark for that. So when they're really close, they're very stable. That's an attractive force at short range, which is greater than the repulsive force of the Coulombic force, which exists purely between the two protons, which tends to rip it apart. I think we're just going to race through here and see what they've answered. Okay. Yes, protons carry a positive charge, so there is an electrostatic repulsion that occurs, I would call Coulombic, but electrostatic, that occurs between the proton and the protons in the nucleus. The strong nuclear force is needed to hold the nucleus together. It occurs between the proton, neutron, and neutron protons. It's a short-range force that is strongly attractive when the nucleus is 0.5 to 1, the diameter of a proton apart. Anything outside this range will be repulsive. What? Oh, no. This nuclear force is not repulsive outside that range. And attractive when the nucleons are... Oh, they're actually stating that the nucleons don't overlap as we understand the Saxon-Woods potential. And they're saying that these nucleons actually spinning in space around each other. And I don't actually understand. Oh, they've got the Bohr liquid drop model. Now, this is a point that, say, a nuclear physicist wouldn't teach, or may teach, the Bohr drop model. That's in 36, but they wouldn't, I don't think anyone would publish a paper now based on the drop model. So they're saying that this model to work has the nucleons actually not collocated in space. There you go. And the problem here is that people from coaching colleges, with looking at the right notes, would get the correct thing, whereas someone doing their own study or learning it independently would miss out. Okay, question B. Outline the features of the hydrogen spectrum that the Bohr model could not explain. And I should have probably explained that. So the Bohr model is the Bohr model is basically a descriptive model which purely produces Lines in quantum mechanics, you have the neutron and the electron having spins which are aligned or misaligned, and so there's a hyperfine splitting of the fundamental helium ground, so the hydrogen ground state molecule, which is famously 21 centimeters in the far microwave radiation. So this is like the fundamental radiation in the universe, this hyperfine splitting, this radio wave splitting, it's 21 centimeters. Yeah, 21 centimeters. That's about right. Yep, 21 centimeters. So they can't explain splitting. They can't explain the Zeeman effect, which again is spin orbit or splitting of, so your quantum mechanical states will split under the influence of a magnetic field. I have to think whether it's singlet or doublet here, the shift of the magnetic field. There, they couldn't explain, also there's a small shift. Aha, okay, well, there is actually small shifts due to deuterium and tritium, due to the I have to think of the name of the... It's actually gone straight from my head. So this is a small... look, there is a small splitting due to the electron actually residing inside the nucleus. And it's gone from my head, the actual name. It will come back to me at some stage, which is, again, a quantum mechanical effect. So that's for 3 marks. And this will be interesting, 34B. Outlines the features. Oh, we've got to do 2 features to get 3 marks. Outlines one feature or identifies a feature. Borel's model cannot explain why some spectral lines were observed to be more... more intense than others. It does not explain why some transitions were favoured over others. So it doesn't explain the quantum mechanical selection rules. Sorry, I just totally missed that one. Quantum mechanical selection rules. So your emission lines will be strong. It's like you can't go D to S, for instance. So it's you can only go one angular momentum. So you can do S to P, and P to S and D, and you can do... there's a whole series of selection rules, and the fact that... The P state is different from an S state. There are 3 P states, so they're strict ratio. So it got none of the quantum mechanics. I missed that one. With more sensitive instruments, other lines were observed, known as hyperfine lines. This indicates there's some splitting of the energy levels that the Bohr model can't explain. So it's outlined, outline a feature, so you don't have to explain it. So there, I absolutely stuffed that one. I missed a sitting duck. So how would I have done that here? Outline features of the hydrogen spectrum that Bohr model could not explain. You just have to basically learn that. I probably would have only got 2. The examiners would be hard on me. Okay, calculate the initial energy level of an electron in a hydrogen atom. This is B2. If it emits 4.089 by 10 to the minus 19 joules on the transition level to the N equals 2 level. So you have to start going back to your equation sheet, which I think I've got back here. Alright, and you have to put the, just sticking it off, not doing anything out of the top of my head, you have to put 4 by 10 to the minus 19 equals H, Planck's constant times the frequency, is one thing. So on the right-hand column, you put things, information you're given. NF equals 2, NI equals question mark, E equals 4 by 10 to the minus 19 joules, H equals something or other, joule seconds, Planck's constant, joule seconds. C equals 3 by 10 to the 8, we put that one in, and then you crunch through that E equals HF, Then you put in the other equation, C equals F lambda, you get the 1 on lambda, and then 1 on lambda equals the Rydberg constant, which will be you'll be given into 1 on n squared final, which is 2, minus 1 on n squared initial. So you have to just grind that through and rearrange it. And I'll just go through to save it, because I've been going for half an hour on two questions. I hope this is worthwhile for you guys. Okay. And so for this, they say E on HC equals 1 lambda equals R into the 1 on n final squared minus 1 on n I squared. So they rearrange it there to say 1 on n I squared equals a quarter minus E on HC Rydberg, and they're substituted in. Get Ni equals 4. Yep, I don't know whether I could have done that in my head. So it applies the correct procedure to calculate Ni. So you actually don't have to calculate Ni, you have to apply the correct procedure to get this going through. So that's in summary. This is a fourth generation answering of questions where I go through, read the questions, discuss the physics, have a go at answering the questions myself, and read the examiner's answers and get you through. And of course, in there I read the formula sheet, so when I refer to the formula sheet in my answering the question, you're not saying, oh, isn't this person's got a huge memory or things like that. I hope that's getting up to the grade of answering questions. Thanks for listening. This is Pedicle Explains. Keep on thinking, doing, and finally teaching science. Thank you very much.